Okay. So I hope you have the two articles that we are reflecting on today. And our goal is to consider Jewish values. So far we've talked about courage, we've talked about selflessness, and today we're going to talk about another Jewish value and how we think about this value in the context of the Holocaust. Because this is a value that is, it's crucial from a Jewish perspective in terms of building ourselves and our Jewish identity, but also in thinking about how we relate to the world at large and how this value can inform the world in which we live. And the value that we're going to talk about today, I'm going to write it in Hebrew, and we're going to find different ways to translate it. This is the Hebrew. In Hebrew, it's referred to as tzniut, or tznius. Okay? Right, Yiddish. So this is our topic today. The topic is one of tznius. Now, the first thing you're thinking of is, why are we talking about...
That's just what I was thinking.
Why are we thinking about tznius in the context of the Holocaust? It's not just because yesterday was Purim and the word aster or ester comes from the word hester, but because this concept, what we're going to develop today is understanding the Jewish concept of tznius, has a lot to do with the story, both in terms of how we understand Jewish experiences in the Holocaust, but also in terms of how we think about how Jews resisted and how they looked at their experience. Doris, you have to grab that. So let's start with translating this word. Because this word is a very difficult word to translate. Let me start with the following. In many cases, when Germans rolled into Jewish towns, one of their destinations was the synagogue. And in the synagogue, they had a particular, specific destination, somewhere they were looking for. And what was that? Right. They were looking for the Sefer Torah, the Torah scroll. That's our lifeblood as a people. Where would they find a Sefer Torah?
In the Ark.
Now, first of all, let's pretend we've never been to a synagogue before, but we're going to go through this and appreciate it maybe with, even if we are familiar with this, with a new perspective. So they're going to look in the Ark. What are they going to find? If you were to open an Ark, what would you see? Would you see a Sefer Torah?
Yes, crowns.
Well, you'd see rolled scrolls.
Well,
covered.
Yes, by?
Gold and silver.
Tell us, what would you see?
You would see an ornamental covering. I don't know what the proper word for that is.
Right, in Yiddish they call it a mantle. Right, you would call it?
A mantle is a German word.
German, Yiddish, yeah. That would be like a jacket.
Right.
The Sefer Torah, you would not see. If you open an ark, you will not see a Torah scroll. You would see a jacket. If you took off the jacket and you opened it, then you would find a Torah scroll. In many cases, and you've read some of these episodes, of Germans taking Torah scrolls out of the ark, out of the jacket, lying them on the floor, and you'll excuse me, not even speaking about what would be done to desecrate that Torah scroll. And the question that you think about when we reflect on this for a second is, well, wait a second. Why is the Torah scroll, which is the story of the Jewish people, it's God's divine word revealed to us, why is it in a jacket, locked in a box, in a building, that you can only open on certain days? And not only that, there's actually the halakha, the Jewish law requires that you leave that scroll in that box and not take it out unless there's a very specific reason why you're going to do that. Did we ever think about that? Maybe it would have been interesting to take a Torah scroll and unfurl it and put it kind of around the social hall so everybody could see it. Everybody could experience it. Ah.
What? You can't touch it.
You're not even supposed to touch the Torah scroll. Do you know that when a person goes to, let's say, receive an aliyah at the Torah, they usually take a little piece of their jacket, or there's a special belt, where they would touch the place. The Talmud says it's not appropriate to touch the Torah scroll with your bare hands. Yeah.
Well, I removed recently.
Okay.
I got two walk-in closets in my bedroom.
Okay.
So you put different.
We're getting very personal now. I'm still with you. Okay.
With different.
Okay, yes. So let's stay with the Sefer Torah for a second. Why is it that the Sefer Torah remains covered? Let's think about that. Then we point out that, wait a second, there's a similar phenomenon. We're in the middle, in these Torah reading sections, we're in the middle of talking about the construction of the Mishkan, of the tabernacle, which is the forerunner to the temple. The holiest, I guess you'd say, piece of furniture, implement in the temple is known as the Aron Kodesh, the Holy Ark. If you came into the temple, would you see the Holy Ark?
No.
No, you wouldn't see it. Why wouldn't you see it? Ah, well, why can't you just see the Holy of Holies?
You can't, but you don't have permission to go in there.
Right. Well, why not? Why didn't they put the ark out in the front where everybody would see? Well, the answer is that when you have something which is extremely precious, which has deep, profound meaning, it needs to be concealed. What did Charles de Gaulle say? No man is a hero to his valet. When something becomes part of the public square, it loses an element of mystery, of concealment, and to a certain extent, it becomes cheapened. What's that?
Too exposed.
Exactly. So the idea, and it's very difficult, therefore, to translate this word, tznius, into English. Because what tznius means is, what it means is the concept of maintaining an inner sanctity. And that cuts across various aspects of life. Somebody who is constantly drawing attention to their accomplishments, to their wealth, to their way of life, like they're constantly sharing intimate details about themselves. So does that improve our perspective of that person? Do we hold them in higher esteem or in lower esteem?
Higher.
Higher or lower?
Lower.
Why higher?
Higher, because if there is something secretive, something exceptional that this individual or this item has to the public in general, you hold it in higher esteem.
Oh, but my question is, yes, they are like that. And if they go around tweeting, I'm great, and I'm not going to get into any discussions about people who tweet excessively, but you can apply that in your own life. If you're doing too much tweeting, I'm just saying. But this is one of the issues that we're talking about. Somebody can be exceptional. And the question is, do they hold up a sign in public that says, I'm exceptional, this is what I did yesterday?
No.
What happens when we... No. That's what I'm asking.
No, you don't tell the world.
Why not?
Why? Because...
Well, you dilute. I mean...
Yes.
But can I just say one thing?
Yes.
It reminds me, my father was a soldier in World War II, and he never talked much about the war. He had 3 Purple Hearts. And he kept them in a box.
Oh!
He kept them in a room that nobody slept in. He kept them under a hidden floorboard in an armor. And he talked about them only when someone asked. So
that is tznius.
Right, yeah.
That's modesty.
Right. Humility.
It's an aspect of humility, but it's a humility that is associated with privacy. And that was a personal dignity with which he carried himself. So do you look at that person and you say, "You have, what's that?"
I said, but it's so opposite of the world we live in today.
Yes, and that's why it's so difficult today. And that's why this topic is a really good topic for this place, because this is a space that you operate in where people are willing to just take 5 minutes of a break from the outside world. Plus, the cell reception in here is horrendous. You know, you can't tweet from down here because you can't. Think about that for a second. We're living in a world that has become increasingly shallow, increasingly overexposed. And for Jews, where you find sanctity, you find concealment.
Less is more.
In many respects, less is more. Now, that doesn't mean that Jews don't value the aesthetic. But we value the aesthetic to the extent that it shares an understanding of an inner value, an inner holiness, an inner self. So that's a perfect, perfect example. So many people of that generation, like your father, is he still living?
No.
Should rest in peace. His neshama should have an aliyah. Three purple hearts. Did he tweet that he had three purple hearts? Right? No. There's a guy, and I don't know how many of you use his story, Nicholas Winton. The Shama should have an aliyah. She should rest in peace, right? How did Nicholas Winton come to tell his story?
His son.
His family pushed him to tell a story 50 years, 40 years afterwards. Why? Because there was a sense of modesty. There was a sense of sneers that my life is not about bragging or showing off or somehow projecting. Sneas is about thinking about the distinction between the outside and the inside. What goes on inside and what's outside. So now we put it back in. So for people who understand that everybody has a soul inside, and that getting to understand that soul could oftentimes be confused or occluded by seeing people on the outside. So tznius is about understanding what is within and not getting too wrapped up with what's on the outside. That's part of the reason why one element, so oftentimes people confuse the term tznius having to do exclusively with clothing. Tznius does have something to do with clothing, but it's not defined by clothing. That's one aspect. That's why also in the context of the Mishkan and the Tabernacle, we talk about the uniform that the Kohanim, the people who served on a day-to-day basis, that they wore. So one of the reasons that they wore clothing is lechavod. Kavod means? Yes, but it means something else too. Kavod means dignity. Dignity. Like halacha refers to something called kavod habrios, dignity of humanity. The person has dignity. That dignity can be compromised if they're put in an uncomfortable situation. So keeping ourselves covered is part of maintaining our dignity. It's part of maintaining that inner mystique that we have. That every person has that inner mystique. Where was that ripped away from people? You take somebody, it's interesting, in the stories that you read, and if you think about it in the deportation section, they put people in that rail car, 80 to 100 people, and excuse me, there were no restrooms. Right? So in the halacha, there is a principle and the laws of Shabbos having to do with rabbinic restrictions involving, let's say, tearing paper, or in Talmudic times it had to do with using stones because they didn't have toilet paper. They used stones. So there is a rabbinic restriction against tearing paper. But the Gemara, the Talmud, in Maseches Brachos discusses how, let's say, somebody finds himself in a situation where they're only, you'll excuse me for talking about this, they're in the restroom, and their only paper that they have is a roll of toilet paper. So on Shabbos, I find myself in the restroom, there's only toilet paper, but cutting that toilet paper, if it's not cutting it to a specific measurement because you want it to that measurement, you just cut it, or you cut it in an unusual manner, is a violation of a malacha derabbanan, a rabbinic restriction. So what do you do? So the Talmud says that rabbinic restriction of the unusual manner of cutting the toilet paper, that is put aside. because of what's called kavod habrios, personal dignity. So the halacha, the Jewish law, recognizes that there is an essential concept that the person has a sense of dignity. That dignity doesn't come from the outside, it comes from the inside, the person's feelings. So you take someone, you put them on a train, and they have to use a bucket in the corner, people on top of each other. What a privation of personal dignity. It's an ultimate lack of kavod habrios. It's a lack of tznius, of feeling that the person has their dignity, their personal space, their respect. It's this difference between the inner world and the outer world. There are certain things that are private, that belong to be private. And when we get into that space and we understand that world, we can understand how horrible on an emotional level the experience of people was on a day-to-day level, especially for women who are acutely sensitive to the idea of the personal space, the personal dignity. And then when that is ripped away from people, that's an added layer of indignity, of assault, of an affront.
Psychological torture.
That's right. So you take, especially, remember, you have to get back into that context where many of these young women who lived in Shtetlach, they didn't venture out into public squares and public spheres. That was part of their tradition. Now, the concept of modesty applies differently in different circumstances. But especially in that context, so to take women and parade them out in public, many times without the dignity in terms of the modesty of dress, like what does that mean? Right? But this is such an important conversation today to have in terms of thinking about what is important to us, the outside or the inside. Are we always sharing what's on the inside and therefore it becomes cheap? Or are we conscious of what we keep that's personal and private? It's very countercultural. But that element of us which is personal and private, that's our dignity, that's our kavod. So the two articles that I shared with you are great resources. A, because they're in English. And B, let's start with the one on 70 faces. This is by Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb. It's called Tznius, or Tzniut, a universal concept, where here Dr. Lamb talks about this idea of hiddenness and the idea of being covered and concealed, as opposed to people who have self-respect, self-esteem. They don't need to wear on their sleeve all the great things they did, because that's a breach of tznius. Their modesty, though, that's such a perfect example. The three purple hearts, he doesn't need to walk around that on his chest because he feels good about himself on the inside from a soul perspective, that this is what he did as the right thing to do. That's tznius. That's the epitome of tznius. And so Rabbi Lamb talks about this at length in this article. And then the second article, this is an introduction. This is called the Tradition Magazine. It's the periodical that's published by the Rabbinical Council of America. And it's a little bit of a different tone, but it's also interesting in thinking about survivors. We'll get back to that part in a second. But here, this is Rabbi Shalom Carmi, who was the previous editor of Tradition. This is from 2010, where he tells an interesting story. And it's not his story. You might recognize this story. There's a woman. She has a husband, but no children. How'd you figure that out so fast?
Education dollars at work.
All right. She has no children for many years. She has another co-wife who has lots of children. She comes to her husband. She says, I have no children. He says, what do you need children? I'm so great. She says, see you later. Right? That's the breaking point. When he says to her, I'm good like 10 children, she says, you don't understand what I'm talking about here. So where does she go? She goes to talk to Ribbono Shalom, to God. See, she comes to the tabernacle. There was a man there. He was serving as the high priest, very pious, sees her, but she never saw a woman who was so pious talking like this, opening her heart, speaking to God, but no one listened, no one heard. So what did he think?
She's drunk.
He thought she was drunk. That's the title of the article. So here is the amazing thing about this story. Eli, he comes to her. That's his name, he's the Kohen. And what's her name?
Chana.
That's right, Chana. Chana is this broken woman. She comes to ask Hashem, please help me have children. So Eli says to her, why are you coming here drunk? She says, I'm not drunk. So what does Eli say to her next? What does she? What does he, Eli, say to her? Or better yet, what does he not say to her? What he says is, Yitain Hashem lach hashelaseich, God should grant you what you ask for. What does he not ask her?
What is it you're asking for?
That's right. Why not?
That's her secret.
That's
her privacy.
That's right. He doesn't say, so what is it? He says, whatever you're asking for, he should give it to you. You've learned this story before. Did you ever notice this Ha'ara, Rabbi Karmi's Ha'ara? Amazing Ha'ara, amazing observation. He doesn't invade on her private space. One of the reasons I wonder if it took survivors a long time to speak, aside from the pain and aside from, for some, unfortunately, lo aleinu, the shame, and this is very important. Tznius, modesty, has nothing to do with shame. Shame is a very dangerous and pernicious quality that needs to be driven out. There's no place for shame in Yiddishkeit. But I think one of the reasons that people didn't want to speak was because it was so personal to them. It was private. And there was an innate sense of, this is my personal story. And for me to open up about that, that's like, imagine walking into a synagogue and seeing an open Torah scroll spread on the wall. Every Jew, the Talmud teaches, is like a Torah scroll. So it means we wear a jacket, we placed in an ark. By the way, at the end of 120, they take us just like a Torah scroll. They put us in a jacket, they put us in an ark, and they put us back where we came from. Right? That's a halachic analogy. That's absolutely an analogy. But the idea that every person has a soul, and that soul, that emotional aspect of us, is like our Kodesh Kodashim. And that's what he develops here, Rabbi Karmi, in the article. And that for many people, he's talking specifically in the Soloveitchik family, but for many others, the world of their emotion was personal and private, and they didn't talk about it. And I wonder if that's why a lot of survivors didn't talk about it, because that was their Kodesh Kodashim. That was their most personal, private space. And how do you open up to somebody about that?
And you're also taking the chance that if you do open up, that you will be invalidated.
That's right. You'll be violated, yes. Exactly. Because what happens, the yes and, we're living in a time where there's so much overexposure so that it's dulled, it's cheapened, so there's nothing to be violated because it's just, everything is out there. As opposed to, if something is really personal to you, you only share it with an increasing number of people. You'll notice, I forget who pointed this out, I saw some research somewhere once, where they pointed out that there is a correlation. The quality of a relationship that you have with someone is correlated to the amount of information that you share with them.
Yes.
Think about that, right?
Absolutely.
Right?
That's true.
What would we say about a person who every experience they had, they put on their blog page? What happened at their doctor's visit, and what happened in their kitchen, and what happened in their bedroom, and what happened at work? What would we say about such a person?
Narcissistic.
A, they're narcissistic, and B, your life is obviously not very valuable because you don't think there's anything worth keeping just to yourself or your spouse or your children. It's a Jewish concept that we say there are certain things that only belong here. Some things only belong at the dinner table. Some things only belong in a family reunion. Some things don't belong, in the newspaper, etc., etc. this value of tznius expresses itself in a lot of different ways. Yeah, what was your...
To be called to the Torah for a reading is an honor.
Yes.
To be called to the Torah to be a reader is an exceptional honor. And to be called to the Torah to lift it up and to press it and put it back in the ark is an honor. And yet some people don't understand it. And I don't speak to others. I'm just talking about what I'm confronted. Young bucks got to show how powerful they are in lifting the ark. It is very physical to do, especially when it's weighted at the one side or the other. But every now and then you get a buck who wants to show how great and powerful he is, and he opens up the ark to the full extension of his arm, which is a clear violation of Hashem to me and others who think the same way. The same thing is true, know before whom you stand. The skirts are climbing.
Oh, now we're getting into an area I don't have any expertise in. Now you're talking. I only know about pants. I don't know about... So, yes, but yes. Yes, and. One second. Let's take both points, Jill. The first point is a very important point, which is that in Judaism, we actually are straddling a challenge. Because what Jill's pointing out is, wait a second. There is such a thing as a place of kavod, and when we say kavod in that context, we mean honor. For example, kavod ha-Torah, honor of the Torah.
If you drop it, you fast. That's kavod.
So there is kavod. There is kavod. And there are elements of kavod. So what we're struggling with and what we need to be mindful of, what you're pointing out, is that, wait a second, on the one hand, we are saying, and we're actually imitating God in this way, we're saying that God is hidden because God is the source of holiness and holiness is concealed. So we want to mimic God. So we also want to be modest, we want to be concealed, and yet we want to stand up in front of the congregation and read. So there is an inherent sensitivity there and a nuance there. So part of the challenge here is, how do we view our role in a communal context as one of service, going back to using the Purple Heart example, as opposed to self-aggrandizement? You know, the people who are doing Hagba to show how many times they've been at the gym that week, you know, is that in the service of Hashem or not? Right? And then the second issue also is a question of, well, wait a second, where is my personal dignity in terms of the form of my dress? Dress, I mean comportment. Entirely. You know, am I attracting attention to the outside of myself or to my inner self? I don't know anything about, because when I was dating Nechama, there was no such thing as online dating. I don't know anything about how dating works today with online situations. But I will say one thing which is interesting. And I don't know how many people read the book Wonder, children's book.
Yeah.
What did he say, if I'm not mistaken? I didn't read the whole book. But if I'm not mistaken, he has a powerful line in there. What's his favorite day of the year? Why?
Because everybody's in a mask.
That's right, because everyone's in a mask. When somebody's wearing a mask, you know what you have the opportunity to do? You can get to know them on the inside, not on the outside. When somebody is wearing or not wearing, whatever it is, and because we're biologically the Ribono Shel Olam, God engineered us this way, there is some element of attraction, which is important. But I wonder if there's actually some element of benefit of getting to know someone on the inside. I don't know anything about online dating, but I can tell you that when you marry someone or you are in a friendship with someone, what is on the inside is what really matters, right? We all know that. So therefore, the question about the dress, and am I attracting interest in my outside, or should we have a conversation of what's on the inside? You know, my daughter is 7 years old now, so I don't know anything about what that's going to look like one day down the road. I need a lot of prayers between now and then. But to explain to her that what she wants to project to other people is not projecting attraction to her outside, but what's valuable on the inside, that goes to this whole story. How do you get to know someone and what's really important about them? Because what's interesting, as if I'm not mistaken 100%, what someone looks like at the outside at the age of 17 is not what they're going to look like on the outside at 57. Right? Is that true?
Totally.
That's totally true. What matters is on the inside. So we go back and we're thinking about what was it like as an experience for people whose tznius was compromised And then how did they react to try to maintain their tznias? Yeah, what were you going to
say? Yes, so my question, because obviously I totally agree that we are in the Holocaust Museum, so there's a big poster right by the Einsatz group of women, a family of women who are
dressed. That's right.
In my tour, I skip by, and that's what I'm hoping you can help with. Because to me, these kids these days, that doesn't look like anything to be ashamed of. So how do you convey this concept to people from our society today for age, for the secular world that they live in, who have absolutely no concept of that?
It's a great question, because how long do you have with them, right? You have a few minutes, but this is maybe an opportunity. And that's part of the reason why I was excited to present this topic, because I think this is a topic that needs to constantly be talked about. Because you're hearing about, you know, there's body shaming on one side of this discussion, but then there's the overexposure on the other. And what these kids, by the way, are exposed to in fifth grade or sixth grade, I don't even know what it is on their phone. I have no idea what it is. And I don't want to know what it is. But thinking about what is that conversation? That's an important... How do we have that conversation?
I'm glad that you brought up that picture, because I've been thinking about it since you put it on the board. I'm not sure what the question is. So that is a religious family that's in that picture. And how do we, knowing that their dignity, their seat, is taken away from them forcibly by the Nazis in that picture, and then were forced to stand and pose for that picture, women with their head uncovered and in their underwear and the whole thing, how do we as docents try to preserve their dignity even now with that photograph being in the museum? Like,
so
are we contributing to the removal of their dignity by discussing and having that photograph?
So you would know better than I would about that question. But what I would do is I would say, let's go back to our why, what discussion and say, okay, here we have a reality. This is a fact. This photograph exists. This family, their neshamas should have an aliyah. They should rest in peace. Their dignity was compromised. This is a tragedy on many, many, many levels. But what does it say to us now? What do we need to reflect on in our own understanding of self-image and what we project? What now? I think that to me is the bigger question, the what question. Of, I'm not sure that it's more of a violation rather than more of a responsibility to say, wait a second. There was a value. There was a beautiful, and again, it doesn't have to be applied in the same way in every circumstance, but there was a beautiful simplicity and modesty that people lived in that time, in that age. And how do we think about that? What are we posting? What are we sharing? Right? I think that's a what question. I don't know that it's so much of a violation of them to address it because it's there. The question, I think, is to say, well, wait a second, what do we learn from that? Does that relate to us in any way? Yeah.
I think it's also an opportunity when I'm looking at that picture, and depending on my group, I sometimes do this as well, just to spend 3 sentences talking about the world that they were from, and it's sort of remembering that aspect of their lives that you're not seeing on the photograph, but yet that is who they were, and this is what the Nazis did, which was particularly cool.
But I think you could still take it even further and bring it into their lives today and talk about, well, what does it mean to share about ourselves? What is privacy today? How do we think about privacy today? How do we think about privacy? Would any of us, now, again, how much time you have and what the age and the maturity of the group is, but like, would any of us feel comfortable if someone took this photograph and posted it online of us? Why not? Well, is it because we have something? A lot of this goes back, Ina's not here, but you should tell her we talked about the soul. A lot of this goes back to that same point that we believe that there is a soul inside of us. Every human being has that spark of godliness, and that spark of godliness is our uniqueness. And when we strip away the personal dignity, we're chipping away at that personal experience, that unique emotional side of us, which comes from our spirituality.
So, it is something that I share on tours.
You talk about it.
Well, there and also when I talk about processing in Auschwitz on arrival, because I explained that my mother was from a religious home. She was a modest girl. She had never been alone with a boy. She didn't leave the house unless her collarbone, her elbows, and her knees were covered. And how humiliation and psychological torture, she would tell you, may she rest in peace, was more painful than beatings. And I just think that there's something...
Great. So let's pick that up for a second. And this is important. There is a... Where did I forget that?
It'll come to you.
Yeah.
While you're thinking, I'll just add one more thing because I just finished Einsatz Gruppen training in Phoenix, and they were sending me materials that I'm going to share here with docents, and some of them showed women completely undressed. And I said, you know what? The women in this picture were not given permission for anyone to see them. So I don't feel I have the right to use those pictures.
So I'm blanking on where I saw this, in which sefer I was learning this, which book I saw this. But there is a fascinating point to bring out in this context, and we can build on it. There is an old...
So all of those pictures are immodest for different reasons. Not all of the women are immodest.
Right.
But when you have this woman holding a child with another child, she's completely exposed in that picture.
Any of those.
Yeah.
So here's an interesting point. There is an old way of looking at the world, which appears in many Jewish sources as well, that there are four aspects of life, of existence. There's earth, there's fire, there's water, and there's air. And what we find is actually which of those are more powerful than the other. The more ethereal, the more spiritual, are much more powerful than the physical. Meaning wind is much more powerful than earth. Just ask my in-laws. They live in Miami. Right? And fire, which is also more ethereal, is more powerful than water in many instances. Anyway, you could go back and forth. My point is that what you're pointing out is that there are two dimensions of all of us. We have a physical dimension, and then we have a spiritual dimension. These two dimensions, if you had to stack them one against the other, the spiritual dimension, that's more core to who we are. So if your mother would, she rest in peace, would have said, it would have been less offensive, so to speak, to compromise her physical than her spiritual, than her emotional, than her personal. And that's part of what Sneas is talking about. Sneas is saying there is a personal dimension that each one of us has, and that when you dig down, that's actually more valuable. That's more personal to the self, to the sense of self, than the physical. So how do we think about defining ourselves? The people who are coming on our tour, when they leave the tour, are they thinking about defining themselves more physically or more spiritually? Let's go back to the T4 section. You know, if you define yourself spiritually, then it doesn't matter if you have a disability. But if you define yourself physically, then, you know, the fit people are here and the unfit people are there. But that's the same, it's the same two sides, the same coin. It's the same idea that there is an inner spiritual core, that you're like a Torah scroll that stays under the jacket. Yeah.
That particular picture, I deal with it a different way.
Okay.
Death is at hand, momentarily at hand. And so you have to say to the individual, whether it's today, walking into a synagogue, or that family standing before those killers, murderers, know before whom you stand. And when you understand that, the meaning of that, you don't wear skirts halfway up your thigh. You don't stand in most of your power when you're before Hashem. Who are you? If you think along those lines, then you say to yourself that maybe there is some understanding that can be transferred there. You don't have to deal with the shame that somebody's being put under, or the narcissistic attitude that somebody has.
Right.
And my feeling is, know before whom you stand. If you know that it's your child, know that it's your maker, then you behave accordingly.
So let's pick up on one thing that Shell is pointing out here about shame, and this is very important. Because why is shame so problematic? Because shame doesn't address the outside, shame addresses the inside. And it tries to tear down somebody's inner sense of self. Right? Shame is the voice that says, you as a person are unworthy. And that's part of the reason why modesty is so important in the Jewish tradition. Because in the Jewish tradition, self-worth is paramount. Self-esteem is the beginning of all development. If I don't believe in myself, you know, I can never create a connection. And no matter how far I've gone in my relationship with God, I have to have that belief that I can always retrace those steps. I can always reconnect. And shame says, you can't. Who are you? You're nothing. You're nobody. You're too far. This is in Hasidic teachings. There's awesome observation. It's a good thing you came just for this. Esther symbolizes the Jewish people, and Ahasuerus, when he's referred to as Hamelech, the king, represents Hashem. So Esther says to Mordechai, she says, you know, I haven't been in 30 days. I haven't gone to synagogue in 30 days. I haven't spoken to God in 30 days. I'm so disconnected from God. I don't feel that I'm worthy to come back. And what does Mordechai say to her? Who cares? You haven't been to synagogue in 30 days? You haven't been in 30 years? What's the difference? You come back tomorrow. And she stands outside, and the king, Hashem, looks at her and says, no, what's up? She hasn't been there in 30 days. Doesn't matter. Because Mordechai says to her, you have that self-worth. The self-worth comes from the inside. Right? That's what it comes back to. This is all about inside and outside. What matters more? And that's also part of this whole online situation where people are posting pictures that are a violation of tznius, but part of the answer to that is to say, that's not me. That's not who I am. That's not what matters to me. You know, what matters to me is my inside. And the challenge, like you're talking about, is when somebody photographs somebody in a way that robs them of that. Yeah.
Yes, to me, I relate this back to what you said at our last meeting about if I'm not for myself, who will be for me? And I think when what they did, like the girls in a picture, like you saw the other picture, which robbed people of their modesty, it destroyed their esteem. It destroyed their ability to have respect for themselves.
That's it. And so what is something that you notice in many of these stories is different people finding ways to try to maintain their own tznius, even though it was compromised in a certain way. Right? That's also an element of resistance in thinking about, so what does it mean to maintain even a shred of tznius, of personal dignity, of modesty?
I heard a story, I don't know if I read it or I learned it somewhere, but it was in the train cars, there was a famous Robinson in the car, and they had used the, she had a bathroom, but used the bucket, and a bunch of girls got up and covered her with, you know, their jackets and let her use it, this bucket, and then after, she was the first one after that, no one did it for anyone else.
That's interesting. Okay, because there was a heightened sense of sneeze, of modesty, of
after
indignity.
After that, they lost it. They lost the
humanization part of it. What, right? What's one of the big tragedies when you talk about dehumanization? So that's the loss of feeling that sense of, I am. Who am I? It's the that's on the inner self. Right? When you take away someone's name and you take away their sense of self, that's different than the beatings, right? That's that sense of godliness within. And so when you take your groups through and you're thinking about, you know, what's going on in their life and what's going on in the world today, I think this is an important topic to think about. Yeah.
The same idea, but used totally wrong. When we talk about Hitler and the Nazis coming to power, we're talking about, like, at the beginning, we're talking probably got after the Versailles Treaty, and really what we're talking about is the German loss of national pride.
Yes.
And you see how the Nazis, not God, but the Nazis filled that void and where it led. So it's, you know, you have that shame, but you also have to fill the shame.
Exactly. So this comes back to the same point, exactly, and maybe this is a place to land, which is this question of inside and outside. Where does self-worth come from? Does self-worth come from the outside? In which case, how I look is crucial. That's really, really important. Or does self-worth come from the inside? How I look is nice, and it's valuable, and it's in a context, right? Nobody showed up this afternoon looking like a schlump. I did shave within the last, I don't remember exactly when. Yes, it was Purim, but, you know, yes, comportment is important, but where is the value coming from? If my sense of self-worth comes from the number of likes that I have on Facebook, or the number of people that compliment me, or the way that other people see me, then I'm going to look for national pride somewhere else, and I'm always going to be chasing it, and always going to be starved for somebody else to tell me you're great, you're important, blah, blah, blah. The outside. But if I say, no, there's a sense of tzniyas, there's modesty because I have a soul, and I have a relationship with God. And my sense of self-worth is an inalienable aspect of who I am. That comes from God. So it doesn't matter. My self-worth doesn't matter what else is going on around me. It's totally irrespective of that. So I can actually project my self-worth outward, even if people take everything away. Even if they take away the outside, I still have the inside, because I still have my godliness. Right, that's where it has to come from. It's got to come from a deep-seated sense of self-worth. That I am somebody important. I value to God. I have no friends, I have no family left in the world. I have a sense of self-worth. And that's why I'm going to protect that dignity. That dignity is an expression of my godliness. It's coming from the inside. Where do people find their validation? Do we find it inside or do we find it outside? Why do people put purple hearts in a box under a floorboard? Because they don't need to find validation outside. They find it inside. Because they know in their heart of hearts that what they did was literally the work of God. So they don't need to advertise it to the world.
For those of you who don't know what the purple heart means, to get one of those things, you have to face death.
You have to be injured in combat.
Combat.
Right? And that's the point. The question of where you find your validation, where do you find your value, what makes you you? If what makes you you is personal and it's secret and somewhat mysterious, that's good.
Maybe some insight into something that happened a couple of years ago that I wasn't quite sure I understood, but now I do when you explain privacy. So a rabbi was going to Israel and reached out to me and said, do you want me to daven for anyone in your family at the hotel? And I said, yes, please. And he said, okay, give me their Hebrew names. And I did. And then he said, okay. And I said, so let me tell you for this one, and I wanted to start to share with him where each one needed prayers, whether it was health or career or other issues. And he was like, he didn't want to hear it, which I didn't understand at the time. And he said, I will dive in for each one to reach their potential. And I didn't understand it until you said that just now, that it was his effort to keep what is private within our family private.
Right. And there are different approaches to that, yeah. And there are different approaches to that, which is interesting. But the idea of thinking about tznias, meaning what is personal to me? How do I define my sense of self? Where is my spirituality? And what's the difference between what's inside and what's outside? And how do I lead my life focused on the inside versus on the outside? Right, the notion of what is sanctified, what is emotionally vulnerable and sensitive and pure and unique, maintaining that under the jacket in the ark, right? It doesn't, you know, it doesn't have to be in the extreme. There are, you know, there are times where people sometimes do share public affection. But even that, you know, thinking about what's modest. What do I say in front of, I don't know, a crowd of 400 people about my wife? Not everything that I'll say to her when the two of us are out for dinner by ourselves. Because that's a breach of tzniyus. There are certain things that are, there are certain special bonds. There are the mysterious qualities of life. That's that kavod, which is nistar, which is hidden. And that, I think, is something that you can think about as you give this tour. It's a very important Jewish value. You could read more about it in these articles. And I thank everybody for coming.